So we're studying the book of Corinthians, and this week we're going to look at chapter 8. It's going to be the last lesson for a while. And before we get into chapter 8, I want to speak to you about something that I've been accused of, and I've always considered it kind of funny and yet kind of sad. And most who advocate for keeping the Torah have experienced this as well in some form. You don't even have to keep the whole of the Torah, just keep the Shabbat, and you're going to find that you could be accused of this or something very much like it. We find the basis for this in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 14. And it says, "But I saw that they were not walking in line with the truth of the good news. And I said to Peter in front of everyone, 'If you, being a Jew, live like Gentiles and not like Jews, how can you force Gentiles to live like Jews?'" See, the problem with this phrase is this phrase, "live like Jews," Paul is rebuking Peter for requiring non-Jews to eat and so forth as Jews. And I put the Greek word up here for you for living like Jews. And it's the Greek word where we get our term Judaize or Judaizer. How many have heard of that? Well, if you've been in this movement very long, you probably have. This is where we get that term, and it's been used over the centuries for anyone who professes keeping the Sabbath or any part of the Torah or Jewish traditions. If they were trying to teach others to do that, they were a Judaizer. They were called this even though the word occurs only in this one place in the Messianic writings. And granted, it could be alluded to in other passages, but this word has only been used in this one place. And what I want you to see today is that it also taints the way we read scriptures. They've been tainted over the centuries by this. Years ago, I became friends with a Christian pastor and I had been witnessing some of the Jewish roots of our faith with him. This was before Sar Shalom. And he was quite receptive. And this was a Pentecostal congregation. And everyone knew where I stood. And one day in the service, a woman stood up to prophesy. And she said, "Thus saith the Lord, beware of the Judaizers." I wonder who she was talking about. Beware of the Judaizers. Well, she's going to have to answer for putting words in the Lord's mouth, because there hasn't been a Judaizer around for about 2,000 years. So if we read the book of Acts, particularly the early chapters, it's true that some of the disciples were having problems with traditional Jews wanting non-Jews to live as Jews. However, when we get to Paul's letters, that's seldom the case anymore. Paul's letters aren't based on that. The point is this. In the church, Judaizer became a word that was used for anyone who professed keeping anything that the Jewish people did or anything in the Torah. Because those teachings were in the church, many Christians are predisposed to read the writings of Paul and assume that's Jews causing the problems. But when we read Paul's letters, the things he addressed are not because of Judaizers. The truth is, while the Talmudim, the disciples, had a few problems with some of the Orthodox rabbis and so forth, most of the problems we read about in the writings of Paul had nothing to do with living as a Jew. As an example, when we studied the book of Romans, we found the main problem in Rome was not Judaizing, far from it. The main problem in Rome was anti-Semitism. There were few Jews in Rome at the time that Paul wrote his letter, because the emperor Claudius had expelled all the Jews from Rome through a wave of anti-Semitism in about 50 AD. And Paul's writing this letter to the Romans around 57 AD. So Jews are just now coming back after being removed from Rome and the death of Claudius. And anti-Semitism has entered into the church. And that's the problem Paul is addressing through his book of Romans. And it's the reason he writes things like this, Romans 11, verse 17. "But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive, were grafted in among them, and become a partaker of the root of the olive tree with its richness, do not boast over the branches. But if you do boast, it's not you who support the root, but the root supports you." And so Jewish brothers are returning to Rome, and they're finding this wave of anti-Semitism has entered into the assemblies, and returning Jews are suffering under this wave of anti-Semitism. Now, we compare that with what we find in Corinth. The problem is not Judaizing, but paganism in the city is causing division in the community. The problem is not living by the traditions of our Jewish people, but continuing to live in fellowship with others of the pagan community, following pagan traditions. And we can see in what he covers in his letter, he covers marriage and divorce, because it's easy and commonplace in Corinth to get a divorce. He covers eating customs because of all of the pagan temples, all the food offered to idols. He's writing because they're not leaving their pagan traditions behind for this new life they have in Messiah. And today we're going to look at Paul do this very thing again. We're going to talk about food offered to idols. And we're going to look at Paul also speak a word and a theology that will become a greater problem for the church than Judaizing ever was. And I can say that because while there's no Judaizing in the church, what we'll look at today will spread throughout the early church until it becomes second only to the church itself in numbers of people. And not just that, but it's alive and well in our congregations today, many parts of it. But chapter 8 begins this way. Now concerning idol sacrifices, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone thinks he knows anything, he doesn't yet know as he ought to know. And so here we can be sure this is not Jewish tradition he's rebuking, because he begins with idol sacrifices, and at this time, food offered to idols was not a problem for our Jewish people. But in a city like Corinth, with all of its pagan temples, there were sacrifices going on day and night. The question is, what do we do with all of the meat from these sacrifices that doesn't get eaten in the feast? The meat ended up in the meat markets. And so you went to your local meat market, and most of the meat that was left from the feast was there for sale, but you didn't know if it was meat offered to an idol or if it wasn't meat offered to an idol. Now you can say, I'm sure glad that we don't have that problem today, but the fact is, we see this even today. You see, the Muslims can only eat meat that's halal. And you may have heard, it's okay to eat meat that's halal because it's slaughtered just like kosher meat. It's treated the same way. That's true, except for one thing, and I'm going to read you a quote here. Meat is halal when it is prepared according to Islamic dietary laws, which include a specific method of slaughter. This process requires the animal to be healthy, slaughtered by a Muslim with a swift cut to the throat while evoking God's name, and that all the blood is drained from the carcass. A prayer is recited during the process. In the name of God, God is great. You see, it's slaughtered the same. One quick slice of the throat, the blood is drained out of the carcass, the same as kosher. However, that's where the differences begin, because then you have the thanks and the blessing given to Allah. And I don't know about you, but I'm not going to eat meat that has a prayer of Allah said over it. It's close enough to being sacrificed to an idol for me. But here's the point. Since the Muslim population has increased, this meat is in most restaurants, particularly the Middle Eastern restaurants. If you like Middle Eastern food, you're going to see a sign on the door that says the food is halal. And if you go to the grocery store, you're going to find meat that's labeled halal. And fortunately for those like me who don't want to eat meat that's marked halal, it's marked. So you can tell the difference. In Corinth, however, it's worse because the meat offered to an idol is not marked. You just go into the meat market and it's all there, whether it was offered to an idol or whether it was not. In chapter 8, Paul's going to speak of knowledge. And the Greek word here is gnosis. And it means the deeper, more perfect, and enlarged knowledge of this religion, such as belongs to the more advanced. It comes from the root word that's used for the two other knows in the phrase. If anyone thinks he knows anything, he doesn't know as he ought to know. And that's the Greek word ginasko, and it means to know, to understand, to perceive. But this word gnosis is where we get a term for a movement that began in the early Christianity. It would be called Gnosticism. And Gnosticism had its beginning in Alexandria, Egypt, and it spread throughout the Roman Empire. In the beginning, it was not part of the Christian movement. It was a movement of its own, but a movement of the Greek culture. However, by the late 1st, 2nd, and 3rd centuries, it will become a sect of Christianity. We're going to find these terms, knowledge and knowing, used over and over in chapter 8, and yet we don't think too much of it because our word knowledge and word knowing doesn't really have the same context as it would have had for Paul, considering that we're seeing the beginnings of a whole movement called Gnosticism. Let's look at where we see this referred to other places. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 20 says, O Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to you, turning away from pointless chatter and the contradictions of so-called knowledge. By professing it, some have missed the mark concerning the faith. Grace be with you. And so Paul is writing to Timothy, and Timothy is in Ephesus. Ephesus was another port city, much like Corinth, and like Corinth, it had many temples dedicated to various gods. And what we find in Ephesus, like Corinth, it was known for prostitution, both secular and religious. And while Ephesus is most famous for the Temple of Artemis, it also had temples dedicated to Egyptian gods, the Temple of Isis, the Temple of Serapis, catering to a significant Egyptian population and commercial ties with Alexandria, Egypt. The fact is, these two cities had close ties with Alexandria, and that's important because, as I said earlier, it was the home of what became Gnosticism in the church. It was the beginning of it. And here in this letter to Timothy, we find Paul addressing contradictions of so-called knowledge. I like the way he puts it, so-called knowledge, or gnosis. And that's causing people to miss the mark. Or we could say gnosis that has been leading people away from the truths of the scriptures and the good news. And so he uses the phrase so-called knowledge because it's not true knowledge at all. He doesn't use the phrase in Corinthians, but we know he speaks of knowledge in that way, and that's what he means by it. So Paul will use another word to speak of gnosis, and we find it later in the book of Corinthians, chapter 11 and verse 18, and it says, For first of all, when you come together as Messiah's community, I hear that there are divisions among you. To some extent, I believe it, for there must be factions among you, so that those among you who are tried and true may be evident. Where you have divisions in the church, you're going to have one party that's wrong. Just makes sense, right? One party that's probably right. And Paul knows this, and so when he uses this word factions, we don't really see what he's talking about in this word factions because it doesn't have the same meaning as the Greek, and I put the Greek up here for you, and it means a body of men following their own tenets, sect or party. It's the Greek word that we use that we translate heresy. Paul is telling us that there are those in the community of Corinth that are teaching their own tenets, causing dissensions. These differing opinions are not rising out of Judaism. They're arising out of Gnosis, other religions, Greek religion. And we can see that Paul had the same problem with Rome. In his instructions, final instructions to Rome, he says in chapter 16, verse 17, Now I urge you, brothers and sisters, keep your eye on those causing divisions and stumbling blocks contrary to the teaching that you have learned. Turn away from them, for such people do not deserve our Lord the Messiah, but only their own belly. By their smooth talk and flattery, they deceive the hearts of the unsuspecting. I went through some of these things to give you an idea what Paul is struggling with here. It's this knowledge, so-called knowledge, that has entered into the community. So let's go back to verses 1 and 2 and read them once more. It says, Now concerning idol sacrifices, we know all of us possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone thinks he knows anything, he doesn't know as he ought to know. If you remember, back in chapter 6 and verse 12, we spoke about how Paul was actually quoting Corinthians. The verse read this way, Everything is permitted, but not everything is helpful. Everything is permitted for me, but I will not be controlled by anything. And when we spoke about this, I talked about how most translations leave out the quotation marks. And without the quotation marks, it appears as if Paul is saying, everything is permitted for me. That's not the truth here, because with the quotation marks, we understand that he's quoting a Corinthian saying, everything is permitted for me. In the commentary on Corinthians, they diagrammed it this way. The Corinthians saying, everything is permitted for me. Paul saying, but not everything is helpful. The Corinthians saying, everything is permitted for me. Paul saying, but I will not be controlled by anything. Well, the same thing is happening here with this phrase, all of us possess knowledge. Paul is using this Corinthian slogan. Actually, he's going to use it against them as we continue. And what we're finding in this verse with the quotation marks is that the Corinthians are defending their belief that they could continue to practice going to the temples and eating food offered to idols. In the slogan, all of us possess knowledge, they're defending this. And I'm not just saying the meat and meat markets. Since nothing is labeled in the markets, I don't believe Paul would have been concerned about that meat. But they're defending their belief that they can continue to participate in the feasts in these pagan temples. However, Paul objects because he's banned this previously. Verse 2, let's read this again. If anyone thinks he knows anything, he doesn't know as he ought to know. You may think you know, but you don't know what you ought to know. And what should they ought to know? He stated it. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. That's going to be the focus of what we're going to read throughout this passage. As we go through this, keep that in mind. He's trying to show that knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And that's going to be the truth, or the ultimate truth of what way he handles this eating food offered to idols. Their knowledge consists of knowing that idols are nothing but wooden stone, and there's only one God. Let's read on. He's not going to argue that point, though. Verse 4, therefore concerning the eating idol sacrifices, we know an idol is nothing in the world and that there is no God but one. The basis for their defense for the continuation of their eating food offered to idols is it's just an idol. There's no God. There's only one God. They're not gods, just an idol. And they're saying, we know that it's an idol, nothing but wooden metal, stone. So why shouldn't we eat the meat? Verse 5 says, even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for him and one Lord, Yeshua the Messiah, through whom all things, and we exist through him. So in this argument, Paul tells us something that I've been saying and warning people about. There are demons in the world, and behind those idols that are just wooden stone are actually demons, and their practices too, prostitution and the other things. Behind those things are demons. And so again, their defense is eating food offered to idols in these temples is they're just wooden stone. There's only one God. Paul agrees there is only one God. There's only one Lord, Yeshua the Messiah, but that's about as far as his agreement goes. As we continue into verse 7, he will again show that love trumps their so-called knowledge, if it is knowledge at all. In verse 7, he says, but that knowledge is not for everyone. Some so accustomed to idols up until now eat food as an idol sacrifice, and their conscience being weak is defiled. But food will not bring us before God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do eat. But watch out that this freedom of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. Not everyone has the knowledge that they have. Not anyone professes this so-called knowledge. And again, many commentators feel that that word knowledge there is in parentheses. He's quoting them. In other words, their knowledge. And Paul is saying most of the former pagans of Corinth did not have a complete understanding that Adonai, our God, is one, or that these idols are only wooden stone. And these individuals would have thought that those eating food of the idols and worshiping in that temple, in other words, some of the new believers in Corinth who were not removed from the Greek and Roman world of these idols and gods and goddesses, if they saw these other believers eating in the temples, they would be misled. Then in verse 9, we find out just how he feels about knowledge, this knowledge that has given them such freedom so as to go to the temples of these gods and eat the offerings and participate in these feasts. He says, watch out that you don't become a stumbling block for those with your so-called knowledge. Verse 10 says, for suppose someone sees you who have this knowledge, dining in an idol's temple. If his conscience is weak, won't he be emboldened to eat idol sacrifices? For the one who is weak is destroyed by your knowledge. the brother for whom the Messiah died. In this way, when you sin against your brothers and sisters and wound their conscience when it's weak, you sin against the Messiah. For this reason, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again, so that I do not cause my brother to stumble. He tells them, you are your brother's keeper. Whether you like it or not, you are your brother's keeper. If your so-called knowledge and so-called freedom causes your brother to stumble, you sin against the Messiah. Now ask yourself this. This is what I thought as I was finishing this up today. Why do you suppose Paul, you know, he knows the Torah front and back. Why do you suppose he just didn't go to these Corinthians and say, brothers, is it not written, lest any time thou make a covenant with the dwellers on the land, and they go a whoring after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and they call thee, and thou shouldst eat of their feasts. You see, what Adonai tells us not to eat the sacrifices offered to other gods. So why didn't Paul just tell them, no, you're wrong. Adonai said, don't eat food offered to idols. Or why didn't he say, just say, brothers, you know the Council of Jerusalem in Jerusalem, the Council of the Apostles, they wrote you of their judgment in the matter of food offered to idols, that we are to abstain from the contamination of idols and from sexual immorality and from what is strangled and from blood. Why do you stray from the directive of the council in Jerusalem? Why didn't you just do that? Well, I think, just think of how much paper and writer's cramp he could have saved if he would have just quoted the scriptures and the apostles' decision. Well, the answer to that is not too difficult, because he spent this entire discourse showing what he stated in chapter 8, verse 2. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And if anyone thinks he knows anything, he doesn't yet know as he ought to know. Again, for Paul, he wants to make the Corinthians aware, no matter what you believe, no matter what your so-called knowledge is, we are our brother's keepers, and that love is more important than your so-called knowledge. You might think you have knowledge, but if your knowledge doesn't build up your brother, if that knowledge doesn't win others to a true knowledge of the Messiah, then it's no knowledge at all. And that, my friends, is good advice for all God's messianic communities. Amen.